And we'll move to the second case this morning, which is case number 11-3426, Cecil Turner v. United States. Another case that has returned for round two.
Yes. May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Linda Mullen, and I represent the United States. The government is advancing two primary arguments in this government appeal. The first is that the defendant procedurally defaulted his Skilling claim. And the second is that the district court erred in finding that the Skilling problem in this case was not harmless. I don't intend to linger for too long on the procedural default argument. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court may have. Of course, we have recent Supreme Court authority that makes it clear that this court does have the authority, although not the obligation, to consider the procedural default argument in this case, despite the government's failure to raise the argument in the district court. We did, obviously, raise the argument on appeal, and we believe that that argument has been fully briefed and fairly briefed by the parties. If the court does not have specific questions on the procedural default argument, however, we would like to devote the rest of the argument to a discussion of the harmlessness of the Skilling error, because we believe that we have a compelling argument on the merits here. There was a Skilling error here. We have conceded that. Obviously, this was not a prosecution about bribery or kickbacks. It was the prosecution, the honest services theory, and the prosecution was therefore flawed with respect to that. That doesn't, however, end the analysis, because as we know, Skilling errors are subject to harmless error analysis. We believe that the district court's misstep here was in hyper-focusing on one particular jury instruction to the exclusion of the other jury instructions, and certainly to the exclusion of an examination of the record as a whole, which is what the district court was required to do in this case. We are to look at the indictment, the evidence presented, and the jury instructions to determine whether or not any rational jury could have convicted the defendant of an honest services, under an honest services theory of wire fraud, without also finding that the defendant committed the straightforward money pecuniary fraud.
But the interesting twist on this case, and what I think makes it different from our other cases on Skilling, harmless error, Black and Siegel and Ryan, which is the Juilliard case based on the new Supreme Court precedent, what makes it different here is that Mr. Turner was charged as an aider and abettor of the money or property fraud. He didn't personally benefit. He was sort of at the top and directing traffic and providing cover for the main perpetrators who were enriching themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a case as in Siegel and the others where he was, in fact, getting the benefit of the money or property fraud. He was aiding and abetting it. Does that make any difference here?
I'm not sure. That's the distinction to make. I'm not sure that it's a distinction with a difference. He was guilty of the wire fraud in this case. He was guilty of the straightforward money fraud in this case. And as this court found in what I guess we'll call Turner 1 in the direct appeal, there was ample evidence of that. Now, whether it was under an aiding and abetting theory or whether he was the one who was directly defrauding should be of no moment to this court. He was guilty of that. And so the issue we have before us is, could the jury, let's assume that the jury found the defendant guilty under an honest services theory. That may have happened here, and we're not disputing that. The real issue is, how would they get there? What would they have to find in this case in order to find that the defendant committed this honest services fraud? And the only way the jury could have found that, if you look at the indictment that charged but a single scheme, there was no separate allegations about honest services deprivation separate and apart from the aiding and abetting the monetary fraud. If you look at the evidence, which was coextensive on the two theories, and you look at the jury instructions that specifically told this jury, in order to find that the defendant deprive the state of its honest services, you must find that the defendant allowed the employer, the state, to pay the employees for hours not worked. So this jury was very specifically instructed that in order to find an honest services deprivation, the jury had to find that money fraud. There was no other fraud here. This really, you know, from the beginning was not a very well-conceived, maybe, prosecution from the government on the honest services theory. I'm not sure that it was a fully formed theory or fully thought out from the beginning, because really, at its heart, this is a straightforward money fraud. That's what we have here.
In that sense, it's not atypical, because a characteristic of this case is that the honest services fraud is sort of an add-on theory.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be running through the cases.
It does seem to be running through the cases, and I think that for a while, perhaps the government didn't really understand or have a full grasp on the honest services theory, and that was thrown into a lot of cases. And obviously, we've since then had a lot of direction given about what should be included and what shouldn't be included. But clearly, this is one of those cases where, when you look at it, this was a straightforward money or property fraud. And that is why the error here is harmless. And again, no rational jury could have found that this defendant was guilty under the honest services theory of prosecution without also finding the money fraud. So for those reasons, we would ask that you overturn the district court's decision. I'm happy to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. We find ourselves here, Mr. Turner and me, a little bit star-crossed. First, we relied on the Bloom private gain theory and had a winning argument under Bloom that the government actually conceded on the honest services theory. Of course, then that was overturned by Sorich after we had fully briefed and argued our initial appeal. Then, after that, Skilling comes down. If we would have been in a different place in time, I think this case would have come out differently. We would have argued it differently. We wouldn't be talking about procedural default and waiver. And now, with the procedural default, we have the questions raised by the Ryan appeal and what the Supreme Court's done with Ryan, which was a pretty stark procedural default decision and I think is now thrown into question. But I'll turn to the harmless error question, which is the question that the government focused on. And obviously the district court below on the petition decided that there was harmless error here because the district court found that the jury instructions were so inextricably intertwined between the honest services theory and the wire fraud theory that those two could not be separated. The government focuses on the definition of scheme to defraud, and the government concedes that Mr. Turner could have been convicted of the honest services theory, which was legally infirm, but suggests that because the scheme to defraud definition included a definition of the honest services fraud, which was allowing an employee to be paid by an employer for work they did not perform.
Well, isn't it a little more than just a definition? Wasn't it instructed as a requirement that had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt before the jury could find guilt under that theory?
The jury instruction itself said to the jury, you have to find all the elements of wire fraud. But the problem with the wire fraud jury instruction is the wire fraud jury instruction itself said for wire fraud, you can convict Turner of a deprivation of honest services. So it was a catch-22. You could always convict under either, and that's why the district court found, I can't tell. And I think if you look at the evidence, if you focus on the evidence, which is, I believe the district court did, and Mr. Turner in his petition covered much more ground than just the honest services theory and the Skilling theory, and I think the...
But in explaining the honest services requirements, the instructions had language to the effect that in addition to all the elements of wire fraud violation, it must be established beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's misuse of his position resulted in private gain. So doesn't that build in that additional requirement that the jury had to find?
That they had to find private gain? I think so, yes. And that's what we argued in our first appeal, and ultimately the government conceded, is that they didn't prove private gain, but they did prevent a private, they did present a private gain case. I mean, they presented the honest services theory to the jury. They didn't give up on it. Their private gain was that Mr. Turner received preferential trash pickup, which we argued the first time around, that's not good enough for private gain, and the government conceded that. So we thought we had taken the honest services off the table, and it was just a question then about wire fraud and whether the conviction under wire fraud was proper, and then Sorich came down and everything got muddled. But I think they did present a private gain theory. There was a question, and there was obviously a question in the district court's mind about whether the jury convicted under the honest services theory or the wire fraud theory. The government's argument is, well, to convict under the honest services theory, it's still a money or property fraud because you're talking about workers who aren't working as much as they should and they're being paid. And I think that's problematic for the same reason that the Skilling Court found 1346 to be vague as applied, and for the same reasons we argued in the first appeal, where's the end point? Everybody gets paid for their job. Aren't we saying that now, because Skilling has found that you can only prosecute bribery and kickback schemes under 1346, you have to prosecute any, you can prosecute any workplace misconduct simply as 1343 because someone got paid for their job? So I think we're still in this cycle. And I think if you look at the jury instruction.
In what sense is this not a straight-up money fraud?
In the sense that Turner, as you pointed out, didn't get any money.
Doesn't matter. He was charged as an aider and abettor.
There wasn't theft. Turner, I think, and I think the question isn't whether necessarily it was or it wasn't. The question is, could a reasonable jury have found him not guilty of the wire fraud charge? And I think if you look at the indictment has a very specific wire fraud scheme charge that involved falsifying documents, and there's no evidence that Turner had any knowledge that that was going on. He may have had knowledge, and he did have knowledge at a certain point in time that Denora was absent from work more than he should have been, didn't even know the other two janitors.
He engaged in a course of conduct to cover up their misconduct.
Well, I think if you look at the evidence, it may not have been for that purpose. His actions as a manager may not have been the best actions. He protected these janitors. That may not, and in hindsight, was not very wise. But the jury may have found that that had nothing to do with the janitor's scheme. That was just the way Turner ran his operation. He protected the people beneath him from investigation.
But we already rejected that as a factual matter in the first appeal.
But I think the question, though, is whether a reasonable jury could accept that. Could a reasonable jury find that he was convicted of the honest services charge and not the wire fraud? And I submit that, based on the evidence and the indictment, it was much easier to find him guilty of the honest services charge, and I think that would have resonated more with the jury. They could have said, well, he wasn't a very good manager. He shouldn't have been protecting these guys. He should have gone after those guys. But did he participate in this scheme that the government is alleging? Did he know all of this was going on? As a jury, I say no. He didn't. And so I'm going to convict him of honest services fraud, which we now know is constitutionally infirm. I think that was a reasonable decision as charged and as the evidence came out for the jury to make. And then if it was, there's no harmless error. I just want to briefly mention the procedural default and the waiver. The government concedes that it waived the procedural default argument below, and so the question is, should this court overlook that waiver? One of the factors from the Wood decision.
Does it concede waiver or forfeiture?
I think it conceded. Does it concede forfeiture? I'm not sure. I thought it was waiver. I could be wrong.
I have to go back and check.
But the Wood decision talks about overlooking the waiver for extraordinary reasons. I don't think the government has given us any extraordinary reasons in this case. I'm not sure finality of judgment applies because this is the government's appeal. The other factor that Wood asks this court to consider appellate courts to consider in deciding whether to overlook waiver or not is that whether the district court already decided this on substantive grounds. And here the district court did. And the Wood decision said that should be taken into consideration in whether to then dismiss the case or overturn the decision based solely on procedural grounds. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mullen, how much time? You have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Do you concede waiver or forfeiture?
Forfeiture, Judge Tinder. And that's obviously, you're asking, because it's an important distinction, and it's a distinction that was made by the Supreme Court.
This is an intentional choice or a negligent.
That's right. We overlooked the procedural default argument in the district court, unfortunately. But we certainly did not intentionally relinquish a known right. And I will point out that another consideration underlying the holding in Wood v. Milliard is that the court was concerned that the parties on appeal would fail to focus on the forfeited issue because they would think that that issue was resolved. And, of course, we don't have those concerns here because the issue, as I pointed out before, has been fully and fairly briefed and litigated on appeal. I would like to address, there is a issue in finality of judgments in this case, whether it's a government appeal or not. And I want to address the importance of this prosecution for a moment, if I could, from the government's perspective. The defendant held a relatively high-level position in the office of the Secretary of State, and he used that position to facilitate and enable a very serious, ongoing, egregious fraud. We felt that it was important to pursue this in conjunction with the FBI and the Secretary of State, and we expended tremendous resources on this case. We thought it was important because of the message that it would send to employees in Illinois, both those employees who work an honest day's work and those who do not. And it's important in this case to remember that we don't just have these janitors who are not showing up to work. Dana Denora had, you know, another job completely during this time and was able to receive full pay for both positions. We don't just have the defendant who's aiding and abetting this fully aware of what's going on, but we have these middle-level supervisors who are trying desperately to do a good job. They are working hard. They are drawing these problems to the attention of the defendant. They are trying to be responsive to the people who are issuing these chronic complaints about the unsanitary conditions in these buildings, and their efforts were thwarted time and time again. That's one of the reasons why we felt like this was an important prosecution. We still feel that it's important in terms of the message that it sends. As this court is well aware, Illinois has been fraught with all sorts of corruption in state government, slothfulness, cronyism, and it is important that we turn our attention to these types of cases and attempt to ferret out this kind of fraud. So we thank you for your time.
Thank you. And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under